deadly little Miho. She won't let you feel a thing unless she wants you to. She twists the blade. He feels it.
Down at Katie's, Nancy's taking the stage. Somewhere outside of Old Town, Dwight's headed to the tar pits. And we're kicking off season 2 of Reel It with a trip to Basin City. Hello, everybody.
Long time no see, or here, I suppose.
We're here. That's a good point.
And you and I, long time no see, right?
Yes. It's been absolutely wild since the semester ended.
We say that every time, don't we?
Yeah. It's always like, a wild time around here.
Almost like academians never get a chance to just kick back and relax.
But yeah. Never a break.
Yeah. We did have to take a bit of a hiatus, which was fine because we had 10 episodes down, not counting our bonus episodes. And that seemed like a good number to cut for a season, right?
Yes. So,
here we are on season 2. Can't believe it.
Yep. And Steven taught a class in 3 weeks.
Yes, a Maymester. Wow. That was...
Normally 16 weeks.
That was very interesting.
Incredible.
We do need to, get you up to date on some changes that will be made to Owls of Palace.
Yes, some very bittersweet changes.
Yes, our longtime executive producer, Reagan, has gotten a job at another university, and we are so proud of her.
Extremely proud.
She's the greatest. Love her so much.
Yes.
However, she will be a couple hours away and won't always be able to sit in the executive producer chair. So, unfortunately, she will not be a regular as a producer. Maybe we can wrangle her down here every now and again.
We will steal her every now and then.
We definitely want to bring her in from time to time as well, but we are, unfortunately, going to have to move on. This particular episode is executive producerless.
Yes.
I'm wearing the headphones.
Oh, yeah. But it's okay. Steven's the tech guru. He knows what to do.
Don't talk me up too much. The other good news, of course, is we're back in the basement. That bracket episode, I just apologize for the acoustics there. But the first floor has, what, like 14, 16-foot ceilings? And down here in the basement, it's maybe 8. I can stand flat-footed and touch the ceiling here.
And I'm unable to move a vending machine.
Yes, that vending machine was so flipping loud. But at any rate, we are back, hoping to bring you next week the first of Shelf Criticism after its hiatus as well.
Wonderful.
So, time to get back in front of this microphone. I've missed it.
Yes, the summer's a good reset time.
And way beforehand, we've been plugging it, we chose Sin City.
Yes, a graphic novel for the chaos. That is the end of the semester to do a graphic novel, which I really enjoy graphic novels. I've always really enjoyed reading them.
I do too. That was the ultimate motivation, right, was that we wouldn't have to read quite as much because we were so busy. But the graphic novels, they're very rich.
Mm-hmm.
Very cleverly done. I love the way they use negative, or he, Frank Miller, uses negative space. It's so well done with the whites and the blacks and the interplay. The film. Oh, this film.
The film is something to see.
What did you text me? It's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot to take in.
Because you had never seen it, right?
Yes, which is so interesting because it is so primarily black and white, but it is still a lot to the eye, which emotionally adds a lot to the film that you also get from the graphic novel, so I appreciate the aesthetic.
It's a film. I loved it when it came out. I remember seeing it in the theaters. This is what, was it 05?
Yes.
So who was I dating? Keisha? Was it Keisha? Hi, Keisha, if you're listening. Probably not. we broke up amicably, if anything. But yes, I do remember seeing it in the theater. I liked it a lot. I watched it again later, and I was like, this is a problematic film.
It was wild to me. The reason I asked you, did you watch this in the theater, is because I could not imagine the experience.
Oh, it was great.
Of everybody bonding over this like traumatic watch because it was unlike anything I've ever seen.
I see what you're saying. Seeing it on the big screen was amazing because it was so visually stunning. I get that it's also very intense film plot-wise. I saw The Devil's Rejects in theaters, so I've seen worse there. But either way, yeah, I think I've seen it 4 or 5 times now maybe. Every time I go back and give it a rewatch, I say the same thing. Oh, I forgot how problematic this film is. And we actually, it was our April selection for the film club here at the university. And again, we chose it because we were going to be doing it as a podcast. And yet again, I was sitting in that room with a bunch of students going, okay, maybe I could have picked a better film than this one.
I think that you have to think about this film technically in a lot of ways. You have to respect the visual decisions, the director's decisions. It's very interesting to dissect in that way without necessarily getting into some of the problematic themes that are in it.
Right. And it is based on noir.
Right.
And noir has a lot of these issues. And I'm okay with going there. You know, if you're going to tell a story, you shouldn't be afraid to hit all the trauma or anything that you need to tell that story. It's just, we're going to talk about it, but this film seems like it revels in female suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that just is...
Not my cup of tea.
It kind of blew my mind.
Yes. But one thing I did like about the adaptation is how true it was to the graphic novel as a whole in terms of dialogue in particular, because a graphic novel is almost all dialogue a lot of the time. I love Hemingway, right? He's a lot of dialogue. I appreciate richness and conversation that you have to analyze in order to find out the themes of the story. And that's what I really liked about the graphic novel, was I had to dissect everything really from that kind of dialogue, external or internal.
Right. And of course, being noir, you've got that voiceover.
Yes.
And you're right that it's almost word for word.
Mm-hmm.
And it is also, interestingly enough, panel for panel. So story time, kickback, right?
Yep.
I like this story.
Story time.
So Robert Rodriguez was deeply committed to preserving Frank Miller's aesthetic. He didn't just want to adapt the graphic novel. He wanted to translate it. And often it's just a panel per panel, you know, adaptation onto the screen, just directly into cinematic form. It's the look, the feel, the tone. And it was so specific that Rodriguez felt he couldn't in good consciousness claim sole authorship for it. So he actually asked Frank Miller and asked him to be credited as co-director. And I remember seeing, you know, I've always seen Frank Miller, and I just assumed he was behind the camera mm-hmm. at some point. He was not. That co-direction is just the very fact that basically Rodriguez considered his graphic novel the storyboarding. And he felt so strongly that he actually wound up leaving the Directors Guild of America, the DGA. And the reason for that, and this does make sense when you think about it, the Directors Guild strictly prohibits directors to get a co-directing credit unless you're already an established entity like the Coen brothers or the Wachowskis. Otherwise, you can't just say, hey, this person co-directed with me. And they want to preserve the sanctity of the director's role. You could have courtesy credits. I've been film adjacent before. And when I mean adjacent, I'm not talking like Hollywood. I'm just student films, indie films. But I do know that, like, they'll throw an executive or producer credit out for anything. There was one time they needed a particular kind of camera to film something, and they're like, one guy had it, and he's like, okay, I think it was an assistant producer credit just because you loaned us this camera.
Right.
So they didn't want to do that with directors. Plus, you know, studios, you know, they might bring in a relatively unknown director and let Martin Scorsese direct 30 seconds of it and give a co-directing credit. So the DGA is against that. But Rodriguez felt so strongly about honoring Miller's role that he chose to resign from the DGA just so he could give that co-director title. And he announced his resignation, was it March, I think, of 2004, right before they started filming. But his reasoning was the visuals, the pacing, the dialogue, it's already there. He said he wasn't so much adapting as animating Miller's world. So in that sense, at least in Rodriguez's mind, Miller had already directed the film and Rodriguez just supplied the cameras. It is also worth noting that Miller gets top billing before even Robert Rodriguez, and that's also deliberate. This is not just Rodriguez interpreting Miller's work. It's Miller's worldview projected onto the big screen without a filter. So the camera might have belonged to Rodriguez, but the gaze, that was all Miller.
Immense respect. I mean, truly. I hope that we have that same kind of brotherhood respect among artists today, you know, where you respect someone's work so much that you're like, I want to give them the credit.
It's common. It just depends. There's some egos as well, I guess.
Sure.
There were some tiny differences, right? Just from comic to film, but it's almost nothing.
Right, like Marv, who really steals the show in a lot of the film. Right, Marv trying to sneak into his mother's house to retrieve his pistol doesn't appear in the film, but it is in a couple panels within the graphic novel.
She's blind, right?
Yes.
And so he's trying to sneak in, but she hears him.
Right.
Yeah, and I get it. That's probably just for time's sake, right?
Right, which I think her blindness is also very intentional, considering Marv's persona and character. I think we can read a lot into that, and we don't get that in the film, so yeah, it's a little sad.
A little bit more depth. But,
right.
You know, you're directing three, and I guess the salesman is like a half.
Yes.
Different vignettes, so you kind of have to cut something.
And Stephen caught this super nuanced difference in the role of Weevil. The snitch Marv gets to talk initially is slightly larger in the comics.
Very slightly.
But I appreciate your detail.
His look and the name Weevil, I think, is just pretty cool.
It is.
And we'll talk about it in my close read, but when you get to the Hartigan Nancy mm-hmm. story, mm-hmm. Nancy's less clothed in the graphic novel. I think that's the nicest way to put it.
I guess in the film, because the film obviously doesn't shy away from like nudity. But I guess it's just their way of preserving the innocence that we kind of have with Nancy.
Put a pin in that.
Okay.
That's my close read. We'll talk about it.
Putting a pin.
I have a different theory, but we'll get to it when we get to the close read.
And I think the greatest comparison that I really appreciated in the film was that they actually used panels, truly brought the actual drawings to life in parts of the movie where the characters went away and then the 2D came in and showed us those panels. I really loved that.
It was well done. It's a beautifully filmed film.
And I love black and white films.
I don't.
I do. I really do.
This one really works, particularly where when there is color, there's color, and that color pops.
Yes, I love the color pops, which was hard not to focus on for my close read.
Ah, yes. We'll get into the close reads.
Yes, my close read. So there are four of the graphic novels used in the film. I'm going to focus on two of the characters that are so interlinked not only in the film, but also in the graphic novels. And I want to focus on comparing our two anti-heroes. Two of the most memorable and iconic characters from the series are Marv and John Hartigan, mm-hmm. right? Marv, I think, is one of Steven's favorites.
I like Marv.
And both men function as brutal anti-heroes. Not really traditional anti-heroes like we think about it, but truly brutal characters. Yet they are constructed with contrasting moral compasses. They have different psychological profiles and narrative roles. And I thought a lot about the psychological profile in this. I kind of played detective when I was psychoanalyzing each character, and not just the role that they play within the overall narrative, but really the role they play in their own lives, who they've become to the people around them as well. Together, they embody two distinct facets of Sin City's thematic universe, because I see this graphic novel set as its own kind of universe. The quest for justice and the cost of moral integrity in a corrupted world, which Steven is going to dive deeper into within his close read.
Quite a bit.
So first, to compare the two antiheroes, let's discuss their codes, right? Because every hero has their own code, including antiheroes. Each character has a paradoxical code that guides them through the equal paradox that is Sin City. Marv is a hulking brute. I just feel like that's a great way to describe him, because I thought about Hulk when I thought about heroes, and I thought about Marv. Or what's his name from Fantastic Four?
The Thing.
The Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, The Thing. He has a face made for this noir-scarred and intimidating persona. He often refers to his own madness, hearing voices and showing signs of delusion and even memory loss at times, which we don't get a whole lot of in the film, but is really built upon in the graphic novels. Despite these traits, he lives by a primitive code of loyalty and justice, which is not what we think when we first see him. But if you really dive deeply into his actions, his loyalty is almost toxic, obsessive, right? Because he's so loyal to this woman named Goldie, right? He goes on a rampage to avenge Goldie, who was a prostitute that showed him a moment of kindness and intimacy. Which to me, on the surface, you're like, okay, he's a vigilante, he's going crazy. But think about why that moment of intimacy meant so much to him. Why that single moment of kindness has become his driving force. And we can infer the trauma that he's experienced throughout his life to make him this way. His morality is simple, but it's unwavering. People who hurt the innocent deserve to die. And while Marv himself is not innocent, we can infer that because of this self-righteous, almost, need for defending the innocent comes from innocent people in his life being destroyed in the past. Because even though Marv is brutal, he only hurts people who hurt others, right? He never takes the life of an innocent throughout the novel or the film. Hartigan is the opposite of Marv in demeanor and in motivation. He's an aging detective. He has heart problems, which we can read a lot into as well, and a deeply ingrained sense of duty and responsibility. When he rescues the young Nancy Callahan from a pedophilic senator's son, whom I despise, he sets in motion a chain of events that eventually lead to his own downfall. Hartigan's choices are guided by a near suicidal devotion to protecting the innocent, especially Nancy. So we get this comparative lens where they're the same in their protection of the innocent, but they differ in their moral compass into how they want to do that. And we see this take a toll on Hartigan personally, and I think his heart condition is also an outward expression of how it's changing him in his soul and in his heart to live in this city that is so against everything that he believes. And what is so unique here is that we have foils across different novels. Right. Normally, you see foils in the same setting or plot so that they can directly counteract each other. But here, Miller succeeds in constructing a literary universe where each narrative builds on the complexity of another. It's honestly no small feat to create so many minor plots that also correlate in a grand picture. And I think we do have to note the genius of that. You have these two foils in completely different plots, but they so obviously correlate. And when it was made into a film, it was easy for them to connect these different novels. And to continue in this comparative lens, I'm going to dive a little deeper into how Marv and Hartigan's thematic functions both correlate and conflict in terms of the two men's moral compass. Marv operates on a deeply personal and seemingly primal sense of justice. That word primal just immediately sparked in my brain when I was reading through Marv's character and even the images throughout the graphic novel of his character. A lot of up-close facial drawings of Marv, like we're focusing on the emotion in those eyes, in that scarred face, and it was just very primal to me. His violence is immediate and brutal, often without legal care, but always aimed at those he deems evil. And he really does seem to believe there is true evil and not just criminality at work here, right? Because there's a difference between connotations of evil and criminal, especially in a city that is focused on this criminal corruption. He's a vigilante without illusions. He kills without remorse, but only when he believes it's deserved. Hartigan, by contrast, is a man of law who is constantly aware of the moral line and fights to stay on the right side of it, even when it slowly destroys him. Which is truly impressive for a 30-year career in this place. You know, I was like, you've been on this line for 30 years? Good for you. Because these people are hard to deal with. You know, a lot of hardcore criminals. He tries to work within the system, but eventually realizes that the system is irrevocably corrupt, forcing him into vigilantism himself, with heavy, heavy personal cost, and we see his heart condition deteriorate along with that moral compass that he's developed. So their thematic function, Marv represents the raw, animalistic rage that Sin City evokes against injustice, a world, apparently, so depraved that only violence can correct it. Hartigan represents the moral ideal, the last honest man who clings to virtue even as it eats away at him. Both characters highlight that justice and Sin City cannot be attained through traditional means. So what do we do when we cannot succeed within those traditional parameters? Both characters also center on violence and redemption. Violence is constant within the city, redemption seemingly impossible. Marv embraces violence as a tool of inevitable retribution. It is through violence that he finds meaning and his own agency, because Marv seems to be struggling with purpose. So I find it interesting that when Goldie is murdered, he creates almost his own agency in the world. Like, he didn't have a purpose, he didn't have anywhere to go, but this retribution is his purpose. His redemption lies in avenging Goldie's death, and he dies in peace knowing that he punished the true guilty party. Hartigan, however, sees violence as a grim necessity, not a purpose, but a necessity. Every violent act he commits carries moral weight for him. His ultimate act, suicide, is not violent for violence's sake, but an attempt to sever Nancy from the evil that would still come after her if he remained alive. So their thematic function here is to show violence as both cleansing and corrupting, paradoxical, just like the characters. Marv uses it to cleanse his world of evil. Hartigan is corrupted by it, even as he uses it to protect. They are two sides of the same coin. Justice through destruction, but one finds meaning in it while the other loses himself to it. We could also compare the two males' convictions about justice for a female damsel in distress. Marv wants to avenge Goldie for the kindness and goodness she showed him, and Hartigan seeks to preserve that goodness and light in little Nancy as well. Ultimately, what I personally thematically conclude is that both Marv and Hartigan serve as moral anchors in a world that lacks any moral order at all. They are the vigilantes of Sin City, each flawed, each tragic, and each a hero in his own way. Their story suggests that true heroism requires sacrifice, and often that sacrifice will go unnoticed or unappreciated, which deviates a lot from our typical stories now where the heroes are recognized. In a world as bleak as Sin City, justice is never clean, and redemption seems like a coin toss a lot of the time. Marv shows us that vengeance, even born from madness, can have nobility. Hartigan shows us that virtue, even in failure, has its own power. In the end, the plot shows a bleak message that there may not be any real heroes, but there is still potential for honor in each person. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. I know that was a lot.
I'm about to throw a bunch in at you as well, but it's interesting that we read our close reads, even though, it's the same thing. You're doing the graphic novel, I'm doing the film, but mm-hmm. they're the same.
Yeah, they're the same.
It's like that meme. They're the same thing.
They are.
But you kind of see, I'm going to talk about a lot of the same points you did. You kind of put a positive spin on some of it, and I don't.
I know. I noticed. I was like, how can we parallel each other and really, I don't know, string out all the complexity that is this.
There's no way to do it all, but yeah. I guess I'll jump into mine, which I just, because I love a good title, titled Sin City or Simp City, an interrogation of Millerian pulp masculinity. Plus, I also just like making people's last names an adjective, so I don't talk a lot about Millerians. The graphic novel, at least in my edition, I don't know which one you had, begins with the Frank Miller quote, Sin City is a world out of balance, where virtue is defined by individuals in difficult situations. Okay. That's sort of like saying you bleed after a shark attack. It technically describes what happens, but let's not pretend like it's profound insight. The line has this big, gritty-sounding, but ethically hollow energy, which is classic Miller, let's face it. Slap a trench coat on a grimace and a moral paradox and call it character development. Both the graphic novel and the film position Basin City as a world where virtue is individually defined, a sort of Hobbesian nightmare where personal code matters more than societal ones. But what happens when the only people defining virtue are hyper-violent men with savior complexes and six-packs like manhole covers? I don't think this is a world out of balance. In a Millerian ethos, it's perfectly in balance. Men act, women suffer, and what passes for justice is meted out in bullet casings and cracked ribs. So Thomas Hobbes, as you probably know, argued that in the absence of central authority, the Leviathan, he puts it, life is, quote, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Well, check, 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 and definitely check. Mm-hmm. There is nothing close to central authority in Sin City. The police are corrupt, with the notable exception of Hartigan. There's a line where Marv says, we're supposed to call them cops, but everybody knows who they're working for and what it takes to keep them happy. Somebody paid good money for this frame. The government is run by narcissistic power brokers, Senator Rourke, right? The religious institution is run by a man who protects a cannibal serial killer, Cardinal Rourke. The only order is enforced by vigilantes, the mob, or, of course, Deadly Miho. In Hobbesian terms, the social contract in Basin City has been shredded, soaked in gasoline, thrown off a rooftop. What remains are atomized individuals asserting their own morality by any means necessary. Virtue in this world isn't a civic duty. It's a kill count in service of your chosen woman. You could argue that every male protagonist, Marv, Dwight, Hartigan, they all construct their own mini-Leviathan. They define justice by personal code and enforce it with brute strength. And here's where you and I are going to diverge a little because we both kind of picked up on this. The justice I see is simply in protecting a woman. And the key word here is a, right? Or at least a small handful of women. But it's not like they care about women in general. The white knight trope is strong, but it's not some chainmail-clad chivalric denizen of Camelot whose personal code is to help the weak writ large. No, this is one specific woman, or women, Nancy Callahan for Hartigan, Goldie and later Wendy for Marv, Shelley and the entire population of Old Town by means of Gale for Dwight. Mm-hmm. But is it pure altruism? It's certainly textbook Miller. Woman is a catalyst, not a character. Goldie exists to suffer and die so that Marv can prove himself. And if you think about some of Miller's other stuff, Selina Kyle in The Dark Knight Returns, she's been brutalized by the Joker and is a washed-up madam who exists just to show how far Gotham has fallen and how righteous Batman's campaign is. In Daredevil Born Again, you have Karen Page, who comes home after betraying Matt and eventually becoming a pornographic actress. She's beaten, she's weary, she's in need of redemption, but that only serves Matt Murdock's redemption arc, interestingly enough. It's his pain, his growth, his victory. She's there to reflect on his rise and fall, but not to experience her own. And then there's Elektra. I love Elektra. I really do. It's a character I adore. But when you think about it, she's iconic, but in Miller's hands, at least, she's not complex. In Miller's hands, she's a hypersexualized, ultra-deadly enigma. Her role, again, is to haunt Matt's dreams, stab people gorgeously, die dramatically. And then she returns from the dead because it's comic books. Death is just an injury, as I always say. But it's not to tell her story. It's, again, to give Murdock more inner turmoil. So back to Sin City. Marv is out for vengeance because he was unable to protect Goldie. And why? She was, and I quote, kind to him. We all know what you mean, Marv. It's a euphemistic way of saying she slept with him. Marv's entire crusade is built on one moment of tenderness that he imbues with mythic meaning. He casts Goldie as a Madonna figure and himself as a self-ordained knight martyr. Marv's not fighting for Goldie. He's fighting for the idea of Goldie. And he doesn't care how many bodies he stacks up in the name of that idea. Now, Dwight's code is a little bit murkier. He helps Shelley because he feels like it?
I guess so.
He helps the women of Old Town because he loves Gale, and he really likes feeling useful. But there's the shift. Once the action moves to Old Town, Shelley disappears from his mind entirely. Gale becomes his new muse, or I guess more accurately, is reimagined as the new/old object of devotion. Dwight doesn't protect women. He rotates between them, devoting himself completely and then moving on as the narrative demands. And also, Dwight, his voice, and it's voiceover. I get it, it's film noir. But he's constantly in this narrative telling us how noble his motivations are. He narrates that virtue as if he's trying to convince himself. In Basin City, there's no real room for complex emotional dynamics between men and women. It's just performative devotion channeled through violence. And here's the kicker. When Gale kisses him again, here's what he says. She almost yanks my head clean off, shoving my mouth into hers so hard it hurts. Okay, that's sexy. But this part. An explosion that blasts away the dull gray years between the now and that one fiery night when she was mine. So let that sink in. One fiery night. Not a relationship, but a one-night stand. Gale's kiss doesn't rekindle a romance. It reignites Dwight's internal monologue. That one fiery night becomes gospel in his Malarian scripture of wounded masculinity. He had one night with Gale and built a whole tragic backstory around it. Sound like anyone else we know? Marv, who had one night with Goldie and suddenly turned into John Wick meets Don Quixote. Dwight says, it's time to prove to your friends that you're worth a damn. Sometimes that means dying. Sometimes it means killing a whole lot of people. And that line doesn't just elucidate Dwight's internal code, but it also exposes how much that code depends on being seen doing something noble. Dwight's not defending Old Town out of altruism. Instead, he's performing masculinity for an audience. Note that he doesn't say, prove to yourself that you're worth a damn. Rather, prove to your friends. It's not chivalry. It's cosplay. This code of honor isn't about goodness. It's about optics. Dwight's virtue isn't internal. No, it's social currency that says it's not enough to simply be a good man. You have to look like a grit-glazed icon while doing it. Okay, fair enough. But what about Hardigan? Hardigan's a pure and noble soul, right, Stephen? Well, Mackenzie, so glad you asked. I don't think there's any argument his actions come from the purest place of the bunch. But my answer to that question is, yeah, he is until he isn't. Or at the very least, until the narrative itself doesn't allow him to be. Hardigan's motivations definitely appear the most noble. Save a little girl from a literal child molester.
Boo.
And I know, we'll talk about him some as well, I'm sure. For a while, he's the only one who seems genuinely selfless. But then the narrative fast forwards, Nancy becomes a stripper, and we enter into deeply uncomfortable territory.
Yes.
He walks into Katie's looking for her, and then sees her performing. He lingers. He feels ashamed, sure. But the film isn't interested in his shame. No, we're treated to yet another Mulvian moment of the male gaze. And if you don't know about Laura Mulvey and the male gaze, just go back and listen to literally every other episode we've done. We always talk about it, but it's always there. The camera lingers on Nancy's body. We're not distanced from the gaze. We're placed right in it. Yes, there are a few moments where we cut back to Hardigan's face, but let's be real. The centerpiece of this moment is Nancy on the stage. And I do remember when this film came out, like, this was the iconic scene. This was the word of mouth that got people into the theater. Hey, Jessica Alba's dancing on a stripper pole. Mm. And it's rather tame, in all honesty. I mean, I've made you watch some stuff. Zombie strippers.
Awful.
Why it's Sargasso Sea. It's not like that. There's some gyration of hips. There's a bare midriff. But, you know, to be a stripper, Nancy has a pretty good square footage of fabric across her. And we talked about this earlier, but my take is probably that Alba was such an A-list bankable name that she could negotiate
good for her
some of that coverage. And that's fine. Yeah. Hey, more power to you. But that's speculation on my part. All I can say is, whereas the film adapts an almost panel-for-panel transfer of many of the moments in the comics, it does dial down several notches as far as the nudity or lack thereof in the film. But what can't be denied is that it's still a very sensuously charged scene. It's even one of the few, if only, scenes where we get full, albeit heavily desaturated color.
Mm-hmm.
And as if elevating the innocent victim of 8 years earlier to an unequivocal sex pot was not uncomfortable enough, the voiceovers here just gets, we'll put it in the parlance of the internet, cringe.
Mm-hmm.
Skinny little Nancy Callahan, says Hardigan. She grew up. She filled out. Nancy Callahan, 19 years old, and here I was expecting a skinny little bookworm, a little too shy for her own good. Not creepy at all there, Hardigan.
Yeah, when the voiceover said 19 years old, I was like, oh.
Twice he stresses she's 19 years old. So at least we got that. To his credit, Hardigan does eventually avert his eyes, but the camera doesn't. It ogles her while he looks away. Later in that hotel, when she kisses him, he does spend a moment kissing her back and giving in. But he eventually breaks away and even says at one point, there's wrong and there's wrong and then there's this. So for all his grizzled, morally tortured Noor effect, he does seem to try to do the right thing. He's the only protagonist who resists his baser instincts in this film. His internal monologue is full of guilt, self-loathing, and near messianic self-sacrifice. The narrative of Sin City splits Nancy in two. In Hardigan's mind, she's the innocent he must protect. In the camera's lens, or the book's panels, she's the fantasy the audience is meant to consume. The narrative treats her like she's both still 12 years old and also a centerfold, often in the same scene. Hardigan sees her as a little girl in need of rescue, but the camera shoots her as if she's auditioning for Wild Things 2, Basin City Nights. This contradiction undercuts Hardigan's entire arc. He's wrestling with preserving her innocence, while the narrative insists on staging her as a hypersexualized object. Hardigan struggles and eventually succeeds in his refusal to sexualize Nancy, but the film does all the heavy lifting for him. Whew, so what do we do with all this? Marv, Dwight, and Hardigan all script their own gospel according to the Malarian code of virtue through violence. And women exist not as people, but as projections. Catalysts, corpses, icons. Each man becomes a self-appointed Leviathan, stepping out of the anarchic void of the city and declaring his own laws. Marv meets out vengeance like a prophet with a hatchet and razor wire. Dwight performs justice like a Noor demigod who poses in doorways and narrates his virtual real time. And Hardigan? Bless his heart. I mean, he tries so hard to be righteous and restrained, but he can't completely escape the gravity of his own gaze. And the women they fight for? They don't get to define justice. Instead, they get framed both visually and narratively. They're protected, punished, and/or fetishized, but the only thing they never are is permitted full agency. Nancy is the final form of that imbalance, if you will, the final girl. If you don't know Carol J. Clover, listen to some of our other episodes. But in this world, the final girl doesn't mean survival. It just means performance. Her trauma is currency, and the camera refuses to let her cash out. Her body, like her story, is something men protect, but also never relinquish control of. So with no single Leviathan, just scattered hyper-macho white knights in sullied armor running around, justice truly is blind in Basin City. But the male gaze, now that's very much alive.
Yeah, and, you know, I get that it's Sin City, right? Like, it's supposed to be the most corrupt, awful place where goodness cannot survive. But, man, I really wanted a flicker. You know, like Nancy. like Nancy becoming, what?
So you've not seen the sequel?
No, I have not.
A Dame to Kill For.
I have not. I didn't know.
Yeah. Nancy's back.
Nancy's back. Is she good?
You just got to watch.
Aww.
She's a, I don't want to spoil anything for those who haven't
redemption.
Seen it. She's a little sad about Hardigan. We'll say that.
Well.
Marv's back too.
Really?
You think an electric chair could stop him?
No. No, I do not. I looked at my husband while this movie was playing. I said, you know, if he technically dies and gets back up, he's free. So.
Isn't that how the graphic novel ends with that? It's like, yep, he's dead or something like that. That's the end of that chapter. Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, I completely agree with extremely female objectifying imagery.
Even like, I mean, the first couple times I saw it, I'm like, the girls of Old Town, yeah, that's female power, but it's like, not really.
Yeah.
If they are powerful, they have to be sexualized
right.
at the same time.
Right.
And I guess to Dwight's credit, he does like, I know they don't need my help, I just want to give it to them.
Yeah, he has moments. It's like you said, then he comes back with his inner monologue, and I'm like, okay, Dwight.
It would be... I love a good voiceover in a Noor. Dwight's story would be better without it, I think.
Yes. Well, I guess now we need to hear from our sponsor.
Oh, yes, our sponsors. Got to monetize, huh?
This episode of Real Lit is brought to you by The Salesman.
When you need help with a sensitive situation.
When your hands are clean, but your conscience isn't.
When someone's presence has become more burdensome than beneficial.
The salesman is here to help. From handcrafted tinctures to bespoke exit strategies, The Salesman offers customized conflict resolution with 100% satisfaction guarantee.
Satisfaction not actually guaranteed. Side effects may include nausea, hallucinations, and sudden disappearances from polite society. The salesman serving Basin City's elite since, well, that's confidential.
Crushed it.
Oh, there were so many options there. I was going to do an Old Town Tourist.
No, fast disclaimer, 100 out of 10. Thank you. Fantastic job. Now, I love that we get to enter into Most Hated Character right after advertisements. It's my favorite.
All of the above.
All of the above. And for Most Hated Character, now, for anyone who has read these novels or just watched the film, I mean, obviously the stinkwad Rourke. I mean, both Rourkes, but Rourke Jr., the child predator, right? I mean, he's...
I don't know if we can say what they call him.
The worst.
Yellow person whose mother and father weren't married.
Yeah.
Yeah, I won't say that word since we're Owls of Palace, but...
I mean, he's a child abuser. Kevin might be a cannibal, okay? Who's also Frodo Baggins.
Yep. Elijah Wood.
Elijah Wood. I was like, what? But at least this character, at least Kevin, has this like supernatural-like quality. You know, it makes him almost otherworldly to where you can dissociate. Rourke Jr. is just the absolute worst. I like that he is such a sickly yellow color, especially in the film. It's a really sick color because, and stay with me here in this literary analysis part, yellow is a color that we often associate with light and joy and childhood. I mean, just think about how many nursery items are in yellow. And the color becomes morphed into something heinous through Rourke Jr.'s visual characterization because he is an abomination of those childhood qualities that we hold dear. And he's cruel to children. I can't blame Hardigan for how brutally he murders him.
Probably the greatest line. I take away his weapon. Both of them.
I mean, he does... He...
How do you choose in a film where you have a cannibal and a child murderer? But while I'm at it, can we just stop and appreciate the fact that the cannibal, this unequivocally evil dude with claws like Wolverine and moves like a ninja and a palate of a rabid hyena, his name is Kevin.
Yeah, I love it.
Kevin is a name of a suburban mortgage broker whose wife is cheating on him with her yoga instructor. But instead, we've got Kevin, like, quietly the most horrifying creation in modern noir. Just, mm-hmm. I love that hilarious incongruity.
Oh, Kevin.
But if I have to choose, it's I'm going to say probably both the Rourke brothers. Mm-hmm. One's a powerful cardinal, the other a U.S. senator. So they have responsibility to work for the public good. And instead, they abuse their power. And, of course, they're the ones enabling the aforementioned cannibal and child murderer.
Yeah, awful. All the Rourkes. They're all awful. But I appreciate how the plot uses very real villains and gives them the supernatural-like quality for the entertainment of it, but really highlights true evil, you know?
And the Rourke brothers. Okay, yeah, the cardinal gets killed.
Yes.
Marv kills the cardinal, but Senator Rourke never gets touched, does he?
No, I don't think so.
He loses his progeny. He's so worried about his offspring with Junior, but aside from that...
I mean, whatever.
All right, let's do some academia style.
It's for enjoy... Like I texted you, the film was wild to watch. It's this cross between graphic novel aesthetics and motion picture, but I don't know if it ever decided to be one or the other fully. Like, it was this cross between both the entire time. So, like, for someone else, it might be hard to watch. I enjoyed the visual aesthetic of the graphic novel pictures, but I understand why it might be hard to enjoy visually. I enjoy the ingenuity of it. I enjoyed the graphic novels because it's so different from others I've read. It's a giant cross between a crime novel, a comic hero, and classic coloring, right, that you see from black and white to pops of color. Love that. In the film as well. Yeah, I really teeter-tottered with the film, though.
I'm torn, because this movie reeks of testosterone and Axe body spray.
Yeah.
It's chock full of casual misogyny and toxic masculinity. And there's some moments, some imagery, and some plot points that are deeply problematic, you know, by 2025 standards, sure, but also by 2005 standards. And there are also some points where the logic of the plot makes the kind of sense that doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I love noir in general. I loved the grittiness in this film, the way you can feel the grime kicked up from the sidewalks just settling on your skin. You can taste the smog in the air. When you finish watching Sin City, you smell like a cigarette. It's just one of those films that sticks with you. The direction's top-notch. The little pops of color are compelling. There's camera angles. The chiaroscuro I love. So, you know what? When I teach, one of the first things we talk about in my class is nuance, because I think so many people are uncomfortable with nuance today.
Mm-hmm.
Me, personally, I'm uncomfortable without nuance. So I'm just going to live in nuance. I know I probably shouldn't, but I like this film. Full stop. Teach. It's absolutely teachable, but it comes with trigger warnings, context, and probably a preloaded critical apparatus. I mean, you wouldn't assign Sin City in your intro to film class during week one. Week 13, maybe, after they've read Mulvey and Judith Butler and maybe a little Foucault and Deleuze and Guattari just to really ruin the fun of watching it. But think about the discussions you could have around genre. You know, the noir is so heavy, the male gaze, both literally and narratively. Adaptation, the discussion of adaptation. Which reminds me, we still got to pitch that class.
Yep.
I still want to co-teach a 300-level class with you on literary adaptations. Yeah. We could just basically take the script from real lit. And
absolutely.
Just teach those.
It'd be so much fun.
It would be. Administration.
Yeah, definitely an upper level to graduate level piece for me personally. And certainly for a film course. Probably a film criticism course. Because there's a lot to digest and discuss in terms of film and director decisions here. I think technically this film is very complex. To me, this is more of a piece to dissect critically through a firm lens rather than discourse interpretation in a classroom setting. It takes a lot of reflection after reading and watching it. And going off that note for scholarship, this adaptation is so complex because the graphic novels are already unique, and the film even more so. Therefore, there is definitely room for scholarship here. I also think it could be very interesting to study how film adaptations from graphic novels compare in terms of visual aesthetics and fidelity to the original plot with adaptations from traditional prose. Because we often, you know, we're like, hey, this film is almost nothing like the book. And we get really upset. I get very upset.
It doesn't bother me.
But for graphic novels, I wonder if it's just a lot more accurate because we already have those visual pieces. I don't know. I just feel that the psychoanalytic theory of how we perceive what we can change, whether through words or visuals, is interesting to consider.
That is very interesting. Yeah, I think both the film and the graphic novel are begging for more scholarship. There's a good bit. There's more on the comic than the film, interestingly enough, but still some gaps. I did a cursory search of our library's databases, and I got over 2,100 hits. My favorite, by the way, Hardboiled Silhouettes, Transnational Remediation and the Art of Omission in Frank Miller's Sin City.
Art of Omission.
I mean, I understand those words individually, but strung together, they make me feel like I should be holding a cocktail and squinting into an overhead projector. But yeah, anybody interested, budding film scholars or literary scholars, there's stuff. You could do it. I always go to the WTF moment.
Lots.
Lots. Let's just start with the obvious one. What is up with the swastikas?
I don't know.
Like, seriously. I mean, I get the one on the henchman that has it tattooed on his head. He's a bad guy. Nod to Charles Manson. And it's a neat visual, the way that the arrow goes through it when he gets shot. But then Miho's throwing stars?
I have no idea.
That just does not make sense.
I have no idea. When I saw it, I was like, really?
I mean, I get that, like, a certain rotten group of people whose names I will not mention co-opted that symbol. It used to be a symbol of protection and power and very positively regarded. You know, I was in Lyon, France. They have a great museum there for Roman artifacts because when they were building the metro, I think it was in the 70s, maybe 80s, they started digging for the metro and they unearthed all these Roman artifacts. And when you go into that museum, you see this mosaic that they found and they kind of put it back together and they're just swastikas all over it. And, you know, this comes from the Indian influence, I suppose, and, you know, some of the further parts east. But it's like, you're just walking, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, right.
But that was, you know what, nearly 2,000 years ago. Either way, that just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't explain it.
Felt very randomly placed, just, I guess, maybe shock factor? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, Mio throws that one, it sticks in Jackie Boy's butt, and then he falls on it.
Oh, my goodness. Ugh.
But, yeah, it's just so weird.
Yeah. Steven, I entirely agree. 100%. But one scene that had me literally uttering, what? Like, I was sitting there, I was like, what is this? Is when Marv gets hit by the car like four times, yeah. Flying around like a flapjack, super dramatic. And then he just gets up like nothing happens.
The guy's just bulletproof and just, you can't hurt him.
It was overly dramatic. I don't know.
That was a good one.
It made me laugh, so.
As far as geek outs, I have two. The first is simple. Dwight's cherry red Chucks.
Love it.
They just so fly against that otherwise black and white. Second, Brittany Murphy. She's so good. You know, she's brash, she's sassy, but she's still likable. The fact that Jackie Boy is so cruel and abusive to her would make us hate him either way, but You know, she's so adorable on top of that, that we don't just hate him, we abhor him, mm-hmm. right? Murphy was such a talented actress. You know, she was amazing in Clueless and Girl Interrupted. Have you seen Cherry Falls?
I haven't.
Oh, my gosh. Criminally overlooked meta horror. It came out a few years after Scream, so it wasn't like breaking new ground, but it's really good. It turns the whole purity narrative on its head. She stole the show in Don't Say a Word, which is not a good movie. Matter of fact, it's pretty terrible, but her performance alone makes it worth watching. 8 Mile. We forget about 8 Mile, don't we? That's Curtis Hanson. Come on. The guy that did L.A. Confidential. Wonder Boys. But yeah. She's so good in that, too. And it sucks she was taken from us so soon. And I think it really hits hard for me because, like, she was literally born 2 days before I was.
Aww.
So you can figure her birthday out. You know my birthday.
Yeah, but so she was November 10th.
November 10th, yeah. I don't know how you remember that. January 8th?
Close. One down.
9.
7.
Oh, gosh. Well, I was very close with yours, but you never forget mine. Yeah, so she was born November 10th, 1977. She should be barreling towards 48 years old, but we lost her at 32. Just such a tragedy.
Yeah. It makes me sad when I see actors and actresses, you know, on the Facebook,
you know,
on the book when they pass.
I actually read that the house that all that happened in, because, you know, her husband died, like, what, 5 months later of the same thing? That house is up for sale, but they actually knocked $2 million off the asking price.
Just because.
Another fun piece of trivia. Before Brittany Murphy, Britney Spears lived there when she was dating Justin Timberlake. And she moved out because she said there was an evil entity that kept trying to push her down the stairs.
Oh, my goodness, no. That's crazy.
Yep, haunted Hollywood.
That's a rabbit hole. And for my geek out, so there are two scenes from the movie that visually just stunned me. Just love to look at them. They're very similar. The first is when the child version of Nancy is sitting in the chair in the warehouse. Bright light shining over her face with shadows casting over everything else. She's in the corner, right? It's not a centered. Rourke's shadow is dominating this white space of the doorway. So also metaphorically, casting darkness over her potential escape route. Just the light on her face, how bright she is shining and not centered in the frame, but all the attention is going to her. The slightest Dutch angle. As it goes in on her.
Now you're speaking my language.
It was amazing. It was so good. And similarly, the scene when Hartigan wakes up in the hospital bed and the other Rourke, Senator, is standing at the end of the bed, covering the white brightness of the open door with his shadowed body. Really strong parallel there, I think. The brightness of Hartigan's hospital bed in contrast to the darkness surrounding it just amplifies the hopelessness and isolation that will begin to consume him soon. And so I just loved to look at them. They were very powerful visually that made me feel the emotions I think they were meant to convey.
And can we just talk about Powers Booth as Senator Rourke? Such a small role, but gosh, he's so
But very good. Effective, yeah.
Very effective. Same thing with Rutger Hauer, who plays the Cardinal Rourke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very well done. Well, any final thoughts?
Honestly, some of my favorite moments in this film are when the overly eloquent two henchmen would talk to each other. It was just so funny how many elaborate words and outdated phrases they used with each other. Just really made me laugh out loud, and I loved it.
Yes, that was, I'm trying to think of their names though. It was Schlub and what was the other guy's name? Klump. Schlub and Klump.
Schlub and Klump. And yeah. They randomly just entered in the scene and was like, because of the aforementioned reasonings, you know, it's like, what?
And by the way, Schlub is Nick Offerman, of all things.
Ah, I did not realize that.
Yeah, he looks a lot different, but that's him. Yeah, I really love the quote where Dwight, when Gale opens fire and he calls her his warrior woman's laughing at the thrill of the blood. And then he says,
yeah,
the fire, baby, it'll burn us both. It'll kill us both. There's no place in this world for our kind of fire. My warrior woman, my Valkyrie, you'll always be mine. And then he echoes what she says earlier, always and never. You know, I was really down on Dwight. I think that's my favorite of the vignettes.
Yeah.
It may just be Clive Owen, but he's so likable to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I do hate that because women in Old Town didn't need him. They could take care of all this all on their own. I like that he still wants to help them. I just wish he wouldn't, like, one time the voiceover doesn't need to be there.
Yeah.
Because he's just... The whole time, he's just like saying, look what a great guy I am.
Yeah, it ruins. It ruins him.
It really does. But otherwise, pretty good.
Yeah.
And those chucks.
When he jumped down from the balcony and you got the peak of the red chucks,
so fly.
I was like, that's a cool scene.
So fly. And Brittany Murphy, gosh, good stuff. Well, are we ready to put a bow on this one?
ready to wrap it up. But it was fun. It was much more fun to talk about than to watch in some ways.
It makes me feel icky, but I still like it. I just can't help it.
Well, I am super excited about next month.
Speaking of our movie club nights, that was our movie for May. First time I'd ever seen it.
Yep. Still the Hunger Games.
Yeah, still haven't read the book.
The first one. The first Hunger Games.
We won't talk about my emotional reaction in public when poor Rue.
Y'all know.
Oh, it tore me up.
I was on the bandwagon. I hopped on the bandwagon when they came out. I have not fallen off of it. I love them.
I was very impressed.
And the books are also good. For our listeners, if you want to read the first one, it's a pretty quick read before our next episode.
You know, during movie club, I started talking about Foucault and Discipline and Punishment afterwards, and you could just see the students' eyes glaze over.
Well, they're emotionally distressed.
It's the Panopticon, man. We'll save that for the discussion.
Yes, and hopefully our special guest star, Sidney Blaylock.
Yay, Dr. Sidney Blaylock.
So excited to have him join us. He also loves The Hunger Games and has done some scholarship with it, so very excited.
He was there at movie night as well.
And we have to plug in Shelf Criticism coming back.
It is coming back.
Next week.
Try to get it out by next week. So Arachnophobia. I promise that.
Ooh.
Gosh, that was back with the film fest, wasn't it? That was the last time, the first weekend of March, that I dropped an episode. I've been so busy, y'all. I'm so sorry. But
April and May.
I am going to get Arachnophobia. Have you watched Anora yet?
I have not watched Anora.
As soon as Mackenzie returns my Criterion Collection DVD of Anora, that'll be the next one on the list. And then, I actually have it here. There's a really interesting story about this film, Forgiving the Franklins. I just got it on DVD. I haven't watched it in, God, probably 12, 13 years. No, more than that. I'm going to watch it, and that'll be the next episode after Arachnophobia and Anora. So, got some stuff lined up. Just got to get it recorded and out to you guys. But I'm looking forward to doing that.
Fun.
I've missed it. I miss being behind here.
Fun genre switch-ups. Love it.
I like to keep people on their toes. Eclectic. I'm nothing if not eclectic.
You should get that on a shirt. That's a good quote. Well, I guess it's time for us to say goodbye to you guys.
Aw.
Well, until next time, Real Lit is an Owls of Palace production. Our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Vahala.
Speaking of productions, our lack of executive producer.
I can't sing. It'll be sad.
It will be sad. We love you, Reagan.
We love you and we'll miss you.
And are you looking to executive produce a podcast, though? The pay is crap.
Pay is none.
I'll buy you soda
but it's
while you're
fun. But it's fun.
It is fun.
And for Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. Until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning. To fade.
Is that what it says?
Yep.
Theme to fade. Outro theme to fade.